The Japanese Zen master Ikkyu was once approached by a merchant who asked him if he'd make a calligraphy for him, something he could hang on the wall as a scroll. And Ikkyu wrote the Japanese kanji for attention. And the merchant said, "So, is that it?" And then Ikkyu wrote, "Attention, attention." And the merchant said, "What? These are the wise words you're supposed to write for me?" And Ikkyu wrote, "Attention, attention, attention." And by now the merchant is a little unhappy. He said, "Is this all? What does attention mean anyway?" And Ikkyu said softly, "Attention means attention." Now those of us here were meditators, so we get the point about how important attention can be. William James, the great psychologist and philosopher, wrote that when we reach the end of our days, our life experience will equal what we have paid attention to, whether by choice or default, whether intentionally or not. I'm wondering if we can push that a little further and connect it with what my Zen teacher, Yamada Koen Roshi, used to call our essential nature. In other words, it's really important to be attentive, but do we understand the nature of attention? Is there something to realize about attention or comparable words like awareness? And the reason I'm wondering about this, there's a kind of an irony that you find not only in Zen, but very strongly there. There's a famous story, for example, of a village girl called Enyadatta, who was rather vain, and she used to look at herself in the bottom of the village well and see her reflection. And one day, she looked into the well, but for some reason she couldn't see her reflection. I guess the water was disturbed in some way. So she suddenly panicked that she'd lost her head. And she went running around the village screaming, "I've lost my head, I've lost my head, where is it, where is it, where is it?" And people tried to tell her, "You know, you haven't lost your head, how can you lose your head?" And she wouldn't listen to them, she was so upset. So they finally tied her to the chair, and one person had the idea of hitting her in the head. At which point she woke up and realized that she hadn't lost her head. But what's going on here? This is a story about realizing our essential nature. Is it possible that what we are searching for in Zen, this original nature, this true nature, this essential nature, is it possible that what we are searching for is what is doing the searching? Is it possible that we miss the nature of our essential nature? Is it possible we miss our essential nature because it's too obvious? Like that famous story by Edgar Allan Poe, do you know the purloined letter? The police come and search everywhere in the house and they miss it because the letter is lying right on top of the table, right? Or to say it another way, when you've searched everywhere for your glasses that they could possibly be, where are they? And I expect most of us have had that experience once or twice, right? So what I want to do in this talk is basically play around, push as far as I can a particular kind of idea, which is this, or a certain thesis, that delusion, including the kind of problems or suffering that comes along with it, that delusion is fundamentally when our attention is stuck. It's fixated in some way. And therefore, on the other side of it, awakening to our true nature, is realizing something about the nature of our attention which liberates it from being stuck in those ways. And I'm going to use the word attention most of the time, but sometimes I might talk about awareness. When you read a lot of translations from, say, Asian Buddhism or Asian philosophy in generally, you often come across the word mind, and sometimes it's capitalized as if it's a Hegelian sort of something or other. But what I really want to push this evening is the idea that mind, awareness, consciousness, attention, they're all talking about the same thing, basically, and that our practice is about waking up, realizing the true nature of our attention so that it doesn't get stuck in the ways that it usually does. Another great Japanese Zen master, Hakuin, said famously, "All beings by nature are Buddha. As ice, by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha." How sad that people ignore the near and search for truth afar. Like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst. Like a child of a wealthy home wandering among the poor. Zen masters sometimes talk about selling water by the river. Now, today, that's still a good, given how polluted our rivers are, that's a good idea. But back in the old days, the point being, there's nothing to gain, right? This is what Zen is certainly emphasizing. There's absolutely nothing that we need to gain, but we simply need to realize something about the way things are, about the way our mind is, about the way our attention is right here and now. What Hakuin seems to be suggesting is that the difference between Buddha and the rest of us is the difference between water and ice, which raises this question. Are we frozen Buddhas? Frozen in the sense that our attention is kind of stuck or fixated, huh? So let me just play with this a bit, using especially some sort of Mahayana and Zen stories, starting with the Diamond Sutra. The most famous line of which is can be translated something like this: "Let your mind arise without fixing it anywhere." Let the mind, or can we say our attention, our awareness, arise without fixing it anywhere. This is believed. This particular line is believed to have precipitated the great awakening of Huineng, the sixth patriarch, the real founder and the greatest figure in the history of Chan or Zen, who himself emphasized very much the same thing. His own platform sutra said, "When our mind works freely without any hindrance and is at liberty to come or to go, we attain liberation." And he says, "Such a mind is everywhere present, but it sticks nowhere." In his teaching, he emphasized that he had nothing, no system of Dharma, no real teaching to offer his students. Quote, "What I do to my disciples is to liberate them from their own bondage with such devices as the case may need." In other words, what he would do, rather than give the students some teaching, he would see where they were stuck and help them let go of that. Huihai, another great Chan master who lived about a century after Huineng, elaborated on the nature of liberated mind. And this is a really fascinating passage here. "Should your mind wander away, don't follow it, whereupon your wandering mind will stop wandering by its own accord. Should your mind desire to linger somewhere, don't follow it and don't dwell there, whereupon your mind's questing for a dwelling place will cease by itself. Thereby you'll come to possess or to realize a non-dwelling mind, a non-sticking attention, a mind that remains in a state of non-dwelling. And if you're fully aware in yourself of your non-dwelling mind, you'll discover there's just that dwelling with nothing to dwell on or not dwell on. This full awareness of a mind dwelling on nothing is having a clear perception, a clear realization about the nature of your own mind, your own nature. And a mind which dwells on nothing is the mind of a Buddha, the mind of already one awakened, Bodhi mind, unborn mind. Lest we think that his reference to mind, he's referring to some kind of special mind that's different from our ordinary mind. Huang Bo, another great Chan master, deflates any delusions we may have about sort of transcendent mind or higher consciousness. One of his students asked him, "From all you've just said, mind is the Buddha. But it's not clear as to what sort of mind is meant by this mind is the Buddha." Huang Bo said, "Well, how many minds have you got?" "But is Buddha the ordinary mind or the enlightened mind?" Huang Bo, "Where on earth do you keep your ordinary mind and your enlightened mind?" A famous corollary of these kinds of statements is the familiar Chan or Zen insistence that enlightenment is nothing special, right? Chopping wood and carrying water. Just realizing the true nature of our ordinary activities. What is the way? Everyday mind is the way. Just this. When Huihai was asked about his practice, he said, "When I'm hungry, I eat, and when I'm tired, I sleep." "And doesn't everybody make the same efforts as you do, Master?" "Not in the same way." "Why not?" "Well, when they're eating, they think of 100 kinds of necessities, and when they're going to sleep, they ponder over affairs of 1,000 different kinds. That's how they differ from me." In other words, when they're eating, they're not just eating, the mind is wandering, right? And when they're lying in bed sleeping, what are they doing? Well, if it's like many of us, they're checking their iPhone, right? All of these quotations are from Mahayana, especially Chan or Zen, but there's also something very suggestive if we go back all the way to the Pali Canon. There's a place in it where the Buddha says, "When the gods seek a monk who is thus liberated in mind, they can't find any basis or foundation for consciousness." Now, what does that mean? One possibility is what we're talking about, though, the idea of a non-abiding mind. There's no basis there. There's no foundation. There's no ground to it. It just is what it is. Let me follow up that with two final quotations here from two other Chan masters. The first one, my own teacher, Yamada Koen, in his commentary on a Zen koan, he said, he emphasizes that every one of us is, quote, one with the whole universe. At the same time, every one of us is extremely poor. For in our essential nature, there is nothing. There's neither subject nor object. There's nothing to be seen, to be touched, to be handled. Our essential nature has no form, no color, no weight, no place to stay. No place to stay. In a word, our essential nature is totally void, empty. On the other hand, this void has limitless treasures. It can see, it can hear, it can cry, it can laugh, it can run, it can eat. In a word, it's limitless. Emptiness and limitlessness are characteristics of our essential nature. Aren't they also characteristics of the true nature of our attention? Of our awareness, which in and of itself is a nothing. And it's because it is in itself a no thing, it can become aware of, become attentive to anything. And finally, the great Chan master Lin Ji. If you want to be free to be born or die, then you must understand right now that the person here listening to the Dharma, us, has no form, no characteristics, no root, no beginning, no place he abides, yet he is vibrantly alive. That's what I call the secret of the matter. Again, is this a good description about the true nature of our consciousness? No place to stay, as Yamada says, no place he abides. One reason I think it's hard for us to get a sense of that is the way that language works. Language always divides up the world into subject and predicate, nouns and verbs, things that do things. And this applies to the way we think about consciousness, right? I am conscious. I am aware of. I am attentive, or it's my attention. That whole way of thinking that makes a distinction between a sense of self, a self that then has the consciousness. But what is this self that supposedly has the consciousness, or is it just the awareness, right? Maybe we need to turn that around. Instead of understanding consciousness or awareness as something that a self has, or maybe doesn't have when we're sleeping, maybe our sense of self is a form that consciousness takes. And maybe not only a form, but a place consciousness gets stuck. Awareness, attention gets stuck because we think of it as a real thing. And then we become preoccupied with trying to secure it, trying to secure something that can never be secured because there's nothing there that could be secured. Something like that, right? All of that is talking about what Zen emphasizes, realizing our true nature. And as I'm pushing it now or exploring, playing with it now, the idea that this is saying something about the nature of our attention, the nature of our awareness. I sometimes talk about the path, our path, as having two parts, deconstruction and reconstruction. So in a way, what I've talked about so far is about the deconstruction. That is to say, letting go as happens in meditation so that we can realize the true nature of consciousness when it's not fixated on anything in particular. But what about the reconstruction side? As I've talked about, I think a couple times earlier here, on previous occasions, I think this is really saying something important about the nature of karma. This is how we might understand karma. Rather than understanding it in some sort of metaphysical sense, karma as some sort of something external to us that kind of is out there, we've created, and then it comes back and hits us, what goes around comes around kind of thing. If we understand karma as where our minds get stuck, then I think it can become very revealing. And this, I think, is consistent with what the Buddha said, because at the time of the Buddha, most people believed in karma, but what the Buddha taught as part of his spiritual revolution was the idea of, or the importance of intention. What creates karma is your intentions. And I think that is really pointing out something so important that if you want to transform the quality of your life, if you want to change how you experience other people and the world in general and how they experience you and will probably respond to you, there's actually a very simple way to do that, although not necessarily easy. That is to say, transform your intentions. You can understand intentions as sort of the more active form that attention can take. But in this case, it's not just about realizing your true nature, it's about integrating into how we actually live in the world. And therefore, what Buddhism emphasizes is the importance of not being motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, not being motivated by them. If we're motivated by those three poisons, as they're often called, by those three unwholesome motivations, then we can see how the mind gets stuck. But if we can let go of them and transform them into their more positive counterparts, that is to say, greed into generosity, ill will into loving kindness, delusion, especially delusion of separate self, into the wisdom that recognizes, realizes, and integrates into how we actually live, the realization of our interdependence, that ultimately my well-being isn't separate from your well-being, that we're all deeply connected. So what I'm trying to suggest here is karma can be understood. We don't have to understand it metaphysically or ontologically. Rather, we can talk about how when our motivations and intentions become habitualized. The mind is stuck there, right? The mind gets stuck there, and that's a really good example of this problem of a mind that isn't freed, but it tends to go in these ruts. It tends to get stuck in these ruts. In other words, karma isn't something that the self has, it's what the sense of self is. It becomes an important aspect of our character. Karma is what I, the sense of self, is, and that changes according to my conscious choices, which changes according to my motivations. Right? So just as my body is composed of the food that I eat, so my character is composed of my conscious choices, which over time, when those choices continue, they become habitual. So they do become fixated. If we understand karma in this way, and it's not to deny the way that karma is usually understood, it's just putting it on a shelf for the time being. But if we understand karma in this way, we can say something like, we are not punished for our sins, but by them, right? I become the kind of person who does that kind of thing. And from the other side, it helps us understand what Spinoza meant in the last proposition of his Ethics, where he says, happiness is not the reward for virtue, it is virtue itself. The virtuous person, the person who lives according to generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom, this person, because their motivations and intentions are projected, or how do we say it, projected, filtered through, because they experience the world in that way, they literally live in a different world than somebody who's motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, right? So a pickpocket will basically see our pockets. But a Buddha will basically see our Buddha nature, right? Make sense? Everything I've said so far is on the individual level. That is to say, talking about you and I, through our practice, realizing the true nature of our minds, our awareness, our attention. And also, not just waking up to that, but learning to integrate the importance of habitual intentions in terms of how, making sure in daily life that they're the positive ones. Because by doing that, we will actually experience the world in a more positive way. But just as people sometimes speculate about collective karma, you know, is there such a thing as collective karma? What do you think? Is there such a thing as collective attention? Can we understand what's going on socially as the ways that our attention is not only collective, but collected? I'm thinking particularly of a book by a writer named Tim Wu, who wrote a book called The Attention Merchants. And he made a really important point that when radio and especially television came in, we had a new technology that invaded the home and collected our attention within the home. And then he says, the greatest collector of all has been the development of the internet and its portal, the personal computer, and I think even more so, here we go again, right? The greatest collector of attention, right? And it's interesting, if you think about it, how when television sort of invaded our homes and when we became preoccupied with watching it, how, of course, what happened there, our attention was collected and the advertising would take advantage of that. And of course, now the same thing works with the internet. And he says, I left this out, but I can add it now. Radio, television are in the home, but now with the internet and the cell phone, it's not just in the home, it's outside, and it is mediating our experience with the rest of the world all the time. And I'm sure I'm not the only person who's ever stood on a street corner and realized that the half dozen other people on the street corner, I was the only one who was there because everyone else was looking at his or her cell phone, right? Right? If you think about Facebook, what's going on with Facebook, right? I can't remember the exact phrase, but it was something about how if you don't know who's paying for this online service, you are. You're the one. It's like they're providing a service to us, but in the process, they are collecting our attention and manipulating it in all kinds of ways, right? And not necessarily intended ways. When we think about fake news and the way that people have been able to manipulate Facebook. But again, it's all playing games with accumulating our attention and using it, manipulating it to make us do, to make us think in certain ways, to make us vote and act in certain ways, right? So this whole concept of collective intention, collective attention, interesting those two words, attention, intention, right? But collective attention is a really important one that we need to be thinking about. Starting with maybe the fragmentation of attention, by which I mean, for example, ADHD, attention deficit syndrome, which is increasing at a rapid pace. I think 5% more every year seem to be diagnosed according to one statistic I raised. But it's not just the diagnosis. There's this other thing going on. There was a lovely article in the Washington Post by a reporter named Katie Getches, who I think conveyed it really well, how this unremitting connectivity that cell phones have enabled, what it's doing to our attention, what it's doing to our awareness. Let me just quote a couple sentences. All it takes is a little time alone, especially late at night, to confirm how much technology has transformed culture and the way we relate to each other. Being alone isn't what it used to be. Is it possible to be alone? You know, actually, I think being alone is something many of us are really afraid of. And thanks to modern technology, it's not something, it's something we can always avoid, right? These days, even momentary solitude seems like something to be avoided at all cost, and technology makes it possible. Thanks to cell phones, no one has to face that stroll down the street, the 5-minute commute, or the lunch line without companionship. Yeah? But the more technology we turn on, the more relationships we have to manage simultaneously, and the more likely we are to ask our best friends if they can hold. I have programmable phone lists and speed dial at my fingertips, and yet I feel more disconnected than ever. Somehow, it's easier than ever to be two places at once, but nearly impossible to, as my mom says, just be here now. Yet being in two places at once has become strangely familiar. You don't just go out to lunch with a friend anymore. You go out to lunch with the friend and the friend's cell phone book. It's so common now to correspond by email alone. It's easy to go for days without actually interacting with a real human being. She wrote that a couple years ago. Since then, I think it's almost sort of, we just sort of take it for granted. That's just the way it is. We don't even notice it so much anymore, right? But her point, I think, is really important about in terms of attention. When we're able to be aware, to be connected with so many more people, and so many more possibilities right now, less awareness is available for right here and now. And the people and things most important to us. A Swedish writer called Thomas Erickson has studied this phenomenon and distilled it into a temporal principle. This is what he says. we're drowning in an info glut. It used to be the problem was info scarcity. Back in the day when I went to college, you spent a lot of time learning how to use the library, right? Does that seem kind of archaic now? With Wikipedia, etc., on our fingertips. Suddenly, like Mickey Mouse, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, we're trying to survive an information tsunami. And the scarcest resources have become attention and control over our own time. And he formalizes this into a law, a general law of the information revolution. Quote, whenever an ever-increasing amount of information has to be squeezed into the relatively constant amount of time that we have, the span of attention decreases. He's on to something, yeah? Yeah. Now, this might seem to go against what I was saying before, if the idea is to realize a non-dwelling mind. But this is no, you know, the fact that the mind might jump around here and there, that's not the same as realizing the nature of your non-abiding mind. It's a different kind of addiction. It's a different kind of being trapped, right? Something else that modern technologies have enabled, especially social media, is a new kind of addiction to other people's attention. He quotes a French philosopher named Girard, all desire is a desire to be, to enjoy an image of fulfillment such as we have observed in others. This is the essential problem with the preening self, unbound by social media, and if any of you are on Facebook, you know what I'm talking about, right? By presenting us with example upon example, it legitimates self-aggrandizement, right? By encouraging anyone to capture the attention of others with the spectacle of oneself. In fact, you can make a living at this if you have enough people. You can add some product placement and get paid by the advertisers, right? But this warps our understanding of our own existence and its relationship to others. He says that this should become the manner of being for us all is surely the definitive dystopic vision of late modernity. The fact that something like Facebook or Instagram or Twitter allows us to sort of try to accumulate the attention of other people. And the fact is that plugs very neatly and simply into, I think, our sense of lack. Some of you have heard me talk about this sense of lack. Basically, what it comes down to is because our sense of separate self, the feeling that there's a me inside, separate from the rest of the world outside, because this sense of self is a construct, because it doesn't have any reality, it's inherently uncomfortable, it's inherently insecure, as I said earlier. It can't secure itself because there's nothing there to secure. And the way that we normally experience that is this sense of lack, this feeling that I think we all have that something is wrong with us, something is missing, something isn't quite right, I'm not good enough. And our number one way, our favorite way of trying to overcome this is not something like money, which I've talked about in the past. What we really want is the attention of others, because that's what created the sense of self in the beginning as a construct. It was the attention of other people. Your mother or some caregiver looks into your eyes and calls your name, and we learn to see ourselves in the way that our caregivers and other people see us. But then we need this attention. We crave this attention from other people. Even when we want money, it's not enough to have money. We have to have more than the next guy, right? Does this make a sense? Make sense? It was interesting, just today on The Guardian, a long article, The Age of Envy, How to Be Happy When Everyone Else's Life Looks Perfect. Right? And guess what it's talking about? Just this phenomenon, right? We live in the age of envy, career envy, kitchen envy, children envy, food envy, upper arm envy, holiday envy, etc. You name it, there's an envy for it. Human beings have always felt what Aristotle defined in the 4th century as pain at the sight of another's good fortune, stirred by those who have what we ought to have, right? But with the advent of social media, envy is taken to an extreme because we're constantly bombarded by photoshopped lives. And this exerts a toll on us, the likes of which we've never experienced before in our species' history. Clinical psychologist Rachel Andrews says she's seeing more and more envy in her consulting room from people who, quote, can't achieve the lifestyle they want, but which they see others have. You see, we can't help comparing ourselves to others. Our use of platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat amplifies this. I think what social media has done, she says, is make everyone accessible for comparison. In the past, you might have just envied your neighbors, but now we can compare ourselves with anyone around the world. Any of our 2,000 friends on Facebook, right? We all know these images can be filtered. We carry our envy amplification device around in our pockets. We sleep, like, where is it? I got it in my pocket. We sleep with it next to our pillows, and it tempts us 24 hours a day the moment we wake up, even if it's the middle of the night. While envying other people is damaging enough, let me just finish this a little bit. Sherry Turkle says there's something even more pernicious. We look at the lives we've constructed online, the lives we project online, in which we only show the best of ourselves, and we feel a fear of missing out in relation to our own lives, that our life isn't as good as the life that we're projecting of ourselves online, right? We don't measure up to the lives we tell others we are living, and we look at the self as though it were an other and feel envious of it. This creates what she calls self-envy inside us. We feel inauthentic, curiously envious of our own avatars. Right? This is onto something, you know? And again, it's this need for attention and how well it plugs into this fundamental insecurity, discomfort of the sense of self. It gives it these new technologies give it these new platforms for lack and lack projects to operate. Yeah. But two more issues with collective attention. The first is maybe more obvious here, the commodification of attention, right? For those of us in the developed world, or those of us who live in the Boulder area, of course, the greatest attention trap is consumerism. And that involves sophisticated advertising, which has become very good at manipulating our attention. Right? Economically, it's not so difficult to make things. The greater challenge now is to convince people that they want them. And that's where so much of the energy of modern life goes. Right? As the pioneering advertising executive Leo Burnett pointed out, good advertising doesn't just circulate information. It penetrates the public mind with desire and belief. It captures our attention and teaches us to want something. That may be lucrative for his clients, but Ivan Illich pointed out its spiritual consequences. He says, in a consumer society, there are inevitably two kinds of slaves, the prisoners of addiction and the prisoners of envy. Whether you're able to afford the desired product or not, your attention is captured. Yeah. Recently, it's become accepted in advertising circles that attention is the basic commodity to be captured and exploited. The new economy, quote, in the Financial Mail, the new economy is not an information or a knowledge economy, it's an attention economy. Obtaining attention is obtaining a kind of enduring wealth because you can use it, you can sell it. And of course, the fundamental principle behind something like Facebook, as we've said. quoting Jonathan Rowe, the basic resource of the new economy isn't something they provide us, it's something we provide them. Mind share. Mind share in the charming idiom of the trade. Now ask yourself, though, what if there's only so much mind to share? If you've wondered how people could feel so depleted, so stressed in such a prosperous economy, how stress could become the trademark affliction of the age, part of the answer might be here. So what Rowe's talking about is what he calls the ultimate enclosure, the enclosure of the cognitive commons, the enclosure of our mental, what does he say? The ambient mental atmosphere of daily life. But I think that's a fancy way of talking about the new ways in which our attention is being collected and manipulated. Time and space, he argues, have already been reconstructed. Holidays, including new commercialized ones like Mother's Day, become shopping days. Right? Did Grandparents' Day ever take off? No? Who was pushing that and for what reason? What do you think? Right? The civic commons of Main Street, no, now it's shopping malls. Right? New advertising is infiltrating every corner of our consciousness and often unconscious awareness. Sports stadiums used to have ads. Now renamed stadiums are themselves ads. Right? TV shows used to be sponsored by ads. Today, insidious product placement makes the whole show an ad. The jewel company Bulgari sponsored a novel by Faye Weldon that included over 36 references to its products. And a New Yorker back in 2005, there was an issue that didn't have any ads because the whole issue was an ad for the retail chain Target. Children are, of course, especially vulnerable. And get this, 2/3 of 3-year-old children recognize the golden arches of McDonald's. In the past, we could often ignore ads, but more and more, that's very, very difficult to do unless we're meditating in some Himalayan cave. And they don't just grab our attention, they exploit it. To quote Rowe again, the attention economy minds us in the way the industrial economy minds the earth. It minds us first for incapacities and wants. Our capacity for interaction and reflection must become a need for entertainment. Our capacity to deal with life's bumps and jolts becomes a need for grief counseling or Prozac. By manipulating the gnawing sense of lack that haunts our insecure sense of self, the attention economy basically insinuates its basic message deep into our awareness, right? The solution to our sense of lack, to any discomfort, is consumption. And I think that's a fundamental issue of the kind of society we now live in. And I think we can understand it in terms of the collection and manipulation of our attention. And finally, one more example, the control of attention. Here, shifting more to politics, right? Dictatorships control people with violence and the threat of it to restrain what they do, but modern democracies control people with sophisticated propaganda by manipulating what they think. And of course, in the last few years, we've become more aware not only of Rush Limbaugh and Alex Jones, but the role of Fox News and fake news. One of Chomsky's books sums it up quite well, manufacturing consent. We worry about weapons of mass destruction, but what about weapons of mass deception or weapons of mass distraction, which may be even more insidious and difficult? To cite only the most obvious example, the disastrous 2000 invasion of Iraq. Remember all that? It wouldn't have been possible without carefully orchestrated attempts to make the public anxious about weapons, which we discovered, in fact, many of us suspected from the beginning, just didn't exist. It was easy to do. Why? Because 9/11 had made us so fearful, and fearful people are so easy to manipulate, right? Traditionally, rulers and ruling classes used religious ideologies to justify their power. So you think of the divine right of kings in Europe, and in Buddhism too, the karma teaching was used to justify the power of the king and also the disempowerment of poor people, right? It's your own karma. Don't blame anybody else. But in modern secular societies, acquiescence has to be molded in a different way. Again, with propaganda. According to the Australian scholar Alex Carey, the 20th century was characterized by three important political developments: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporations, and the growth of propaganda as a way for corporations to defend themselves from democracy. Corporations are not mentioned in the Constitution because the founding fathers were wary of them. But of course, corporate power in this country expanded dramatically at the end of the 19th century, so successfully that I think it's correct to say there's no clear distinction between corporate power and political power, between the economy, the people who control the top of the economy, and the people who control, especially since Citizen United. It's really hard to see any distinction between them, right? Both the economic and the political basically have the same goal. They identify wholeheartedly with continuous economic growth, regardless of its social or ecological effects, right? And of course, this often requires foreign intervention for access. Our access to resources and markets must be protected, usually under the disguise of protecting ourselves, right? I'm reminded, and again, I think this reflects on what's happened politically the last couple decades. Huey Long, way back in the 30s, he put it so well. He said, "You've got a set of Republican waiters on one side and a set of Democratic waiters on the other side, but no matter which set of waiters bring you the dish, the legislative grub is all prepared in the same Wall Street kitchen." Ouch. Yeah? Anyway, continual economic growth requires that we define ourselves primarily as workers and consumers, and that our present government and economy are the best in the world, or at least they used to be and they will be again, because we're going to make America great again, right? Instead of raising questions about this, the mainstream media, our collective nervous system, seem to rationalize it. Only a very narrow spectrum of opinion is acceptable, considered realistic, and whatever problems arise, they're just very small ones that, you know, someone like Bernie tried to come along and make a larger critique, but well, we saw where that got him. As the earth begins to burn, as ecosystems start to collapse, the media focus attention on the really important things like Super Bowl, the price of gas, the latest sex scandal, and so forth. Okay, so let me wrap this up. Who controls our attention? Who owns our attention? And who should have the right to decide what happens to it? Rowe says we need a new freedom movement to battle for the cognitive commons. Maybe we call that the attention commons. If we have no choice regarding what fills our attention, then we really have no choice at all. Wu, in his book, The Attention Merchants, says we need a human reclamation project. For comparison, consider the sort of effort undertaken to reclaim some natural resource, maybe convert a parking lot back into wilderness, for example. Over the coming century, he says, the most vital human resource in need of conservation and protection is likely to be our own consciousness and mental space. At bottom, he says, whether we acknowledge it or not, the attention merchants have come to play an important part in our lives and the future of the human race, insofar as that future will be nothing more than the running total of our individual mental states. If we desire a future that avoids the enslavement of the propaganda state, as well as the narcosis of the consumer and celebrity culture, we must first acknowledge the preciousness of our attention and resolve not to part with it as cheaply as we have been. This is woo. It sounds like a Buddhist, huh? And we must act individually and collectively to make our attention our own again, and so reclaim ownership of the very experience of living. Thank you.